Hello, I'm Niall Kahn, and this is the PPRO Podcast. Every other week on the PPRO Podcast, I sit down with James Booth and sometimes a guest to discuss all the latest investments, innovations, and acquisitions that have taken place over the last weeks. This week, I'm pleased to be joined by James Booth and Matt Jackson, one of our frequent guests. Both of you, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you both here.
Thank you, Noel. It's very strange for James and I to actually be in the same office at the same time, so it's nice to be able to do this together.
I'm glad I could help facilitate this magic.
It's a rare occurrence, so hopefully this happens again and more often.
All right, guys. So I think the main story of the last week has really been Alibaba and Alipay. So let's actually kick this conversation off with a little bit about Singles Day, a little recap. Matt, at least can you give us a little bit of background on what this meant for PPRO?
Yeah, certainly. So from the PPRO perspective, I know we had a lot of people invest a lot of time making sure that we could stand up our services to support the massive increase in volume that happens around Single Day, and really happy to report that it was a roaring success from a technical and commercial standpoint for PPRO.
Yeah, James, many people aren't familiar with Singles Day yet. There was a hashtag on Twitter, Singles Day, and many people took that to celebrate their single life. So could you actually tell us what Singles Day is?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think going back to the beginning, Singles Day really was a holiday made up by Alibaba just to really combat Black Friday coming out of the US. And they decided to use 11/11 as that day to really turn it into a shopping festival. I think it's grown and sprouted into something that's really outgrown Alibaba and AliExpress as a group, and now it's turned into a full-on regional holiday in Southeast Asia. Well, not holiday, it's a shopping festival within Southeast Asia. It hasn't really impacted Europe or the US just to date, but there are quite a few key retailers who are starting to build campaigns at least around Singles Day. And we can definitely see that at least when it comes to PPRO's traction or our local payment methods, seeing how the volume's been growing over the past few years on 11/11 is certainly indicative of the wider, let's say, 11/11 shopping trend.
You mentioned the nearest equivalent that many Europeans and North Americans might have is Black Friday. But in reality, Singles Day is so much bigger than Black Friday, right? Can you run us through some of the numbers?
So I think the volume numbers that are spoken about often are that Singles Day alone is worth three times the amount of Black Friday and Cyber Monday combined. That speaks quite a lot about the population that it's marketed to, but also gives an idea of how much that population buys into the idea of a shopping festival across 2 days.
And just to give us a sense of the amount of transactions that are actually happening on Singles Day, what do the figures look like on an average day for PPRO versus the peak time at Singles Day?
It's definitely sort of more than 10x in that region. It's a huge, huge, huge spike that we see and a massive impact to the business and a massive impact to our systems, which is why we put a lot of preparation into an event like this.
There's a stat Alibaba come out with that they got to $38 billion in total sales, which is a 26% increase year over year.
Yeah, despite these huge numbers and this massive increase, as you just mentioned, Matt, Jack Ma was still disappointed in the overall Singles Day results. He blamed it partially on it being a Monday, and also the fact that the weather was still warm in China, so that people were less inclined to buy new clothing.
Very, very interesting that he sees that then as a disappointing fact. I was actually caught a tiny snippet of a documentary yesterday about British supermarkets and how the weather affects their sales, and they have to make some quite quick changes in planning decisions about what merchandise they're going to stock. So it does make sense. It's to be disappointed in 38 billion sales in one day is crazy for us, they set high expectations of themselves.
But I think it makes sense when you look at the overall strategy of Singles Day. To go back to how it eventually started, Singles, I don't think it's fair to call it Singles Day anymore. Let's say 11/11 is more the kickoff of a 20-day festival or so in China, at least in the wider area. And it's the initial sale is through all of the e-commerce websites, but it's actually starting to become more interactive. There's a lot of, let's say, in-person sales happening. There's a lot of festivals happening around it. So maybe part of their disappointment was around their interactivity of 11/11 and not purely just the sales, because you can't really be disappointed with that number. Maybe you want it to be a bit higher, but maybe you thought that 11/11 would have a wider impact on the country or the region.
Yeah.
Well, right. So one of the ways that he would like to increase the impact of Singles Day is to actually make it a national holiday in China.
From a Western point of view, can you imagine if Amazon or a big British retailer, someone like Marks and Spencer's, approached the government and asked for a shopping event they were running to be declared as a national holiday? I just don't think anybody has that sort of impact in the West that potentially Alibaba do over there.
I can't imagine. No, it's really quite incredible. And Alibaba wasn't only in the news this week as a Singles Day, but they also have opened up their payment app for foreigners living and visiting in China.
I think that's really cool. I was in China last year and relied on my friends, who is a local, ability to pay for things at market stores and things like that. So opening up that capability, I think, is a very sensible move. And I think it will only go further to increase their relevance in that market.
Yeah. The only skeptical point that I have with that is obviously the controls that you have to, or let's say the hoops that you have to jump through in order to gain access to the wallet as a foreigner. And I think there's still a bit of hesitation, or there might be a bit of hesitation from consumers, because as a foreigner, for any of us to use the app, we'd obviously have to download the app, register for an account, obviously register for the international account. And then along with that, you have to upload your passport, mm-hmm. you have to upload your travel details. I mean, we already know that China's a bit of a surveillance state. Mm. And I think some people might be uncomfortable with that, especially coming from a Western perspective where we kind of enjoy our freedom.
Yeah, at the time I went to China, I was actually working for a media company, and the extra hoops I had to go through to get for a visa just to visit the country was insane. The CEO had to write a letter to the embassy stating that I wasn't going to conduct any business while I was there. And we had to go through two or three versions of that letter. I wonder if going forward, going back to your point, Niall, around Alibaba's influence, maybe having a public holiday, maybe at some point Alibaba and perhaps Tencent with WeChat Pay may tie this into the visa process, because, you know, to pay for things over there, you need one or both of those apps. If you tie that into a visa process as well, maybe that smooths the flow and makes it a bit less friction.
Well, I think it'll smooth the process, and it'll also just allow the Chinese government just to monitor you whilst you're there. I mean, moving on from Alipay and the big Chinese fintechs, over in the US, Facebook has just announced Facebook Pay. So we all know that Facebook's very interested in financial technology, with the Libra Association and a few types of products that they've been trying to launch. But they recently announced on Tuesday a new product called Facebook Pay.
Yeah, and this payment method works across all of Facebook's various platforms. So that's Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp.
I think they're the big ones, and I think what this might do is provide a really good use case for that influencer marketing type commerce that we're seeing is becoming really relevant. A company like Gymshark rely on almost exclusively influencers for their marketing. And if Facebook through Instagram can now facilitate a payment more easily than currently, I think it opens up a whole new market for that type of marketing and commerce, which could be a really interesting use case.
But actually digging a little bit deeper into this, I'm reading through a little bit about Facebook Pay, and it kind of looks like it's really just a hosted checkout page for all of the different Facebook products. I mean, in one way, it looks like an e-wallet, but essentially it just has tokenized card payments on the back end that it looks like it's powered by Stripe, as well as PayPal. So it's almost just a unified hosted payment page for each of the products. So I don't know how, let's say, innovative this actually is.
Certainly, I don't think it's innovative. How they use it is where the innovation might come from. And my concern may be that you're now having, on the mobile form factor, a number of different ways to pay. So if you've got Apple Pay enabled and Facebook Pay is on your device, you've probably got a PayPal and maybe some other wallets on there. That form factor has been saturated with different ways to pay and at some point, I think we might need to see some consolidation or someone put a wrapper around potentially having a platform for managing all of these different payment methods.
Yeah, no, that's true. And actually also in this article, one of the things that jumps out to me is Facebook have made it clear that Facebook Pay is not connected to their Libra cryptocurrency project. So they actually want to have nothing to do with it.
I think they said similarly when they purchased WhatsApp, they wouldn't be able to identify users across each different platform, which later transpired that they absolutely could.
One of the other headlines in the news from another major American tech company, Apple, it seems that maybe Apple Pay might be just a little bit sexist.
And this is really interesting to me because it seems that people are calling their algorithm sexist. Now, at some point, somebody's written that algorithm and not technically or intelligent enough to understand exactly how an algorithm developed after it's first written. Is there some machine learning or AI going on there? But at some point, it seems this algorithm is differentiating offers it makes for credit limits by gender, which doesn't make any sort of commercial or ethical sense.
Yeah. And I think it depends how the algorithm's built, because I've actually seen a few documentaries back in the day about how algorithms, if designed in a certain way, can become really extreme in a short period of time. Mm. Even when it comes to determining users' classes, their sexes, their race, and it'll quickly stereotype users off what information is available online. So maybe today we're becoming a more, let's say, open and accepting society. But when you actually look at all the data that we have online, you look at all of the old history and all the old records, especially probably old financial records, where actually the majority of the household income came from historically the male in the household. Yeah. These systems might be going back and saying, actually, that's where all of the income came from. And it's not necessarily looking at social factors that point forward that says, actually, maybe a female should be given just as much credit, which they rightly should be.
Now, the promise of the Apple Card was basically, it was going to be an Apple product. It was going to be perfect. There weren't going to be any hiccups along the way. What do you guys think this does to the image of that?
Honestly, from an end consumer point of view, I don't think it does much. We're interested in it because we're in the industry and geek out on things like this. But I always use my friends and my wife as a test of this. And I wonder if certainly no one has come and said to me, oh, have you seen this, knowing that I work in payments? So I doubt there's too much of an impact on the end user, certainly in the UK market.
I mentioned this to my fiance and she didn't bat an eyelid. She was like, never heard of it. Didn't really bother her. If anything, she said it might be good for her so she doesn't do as much Christmas shopping.
Oh, man. Okay.
What's your view on that, Noel?
You know, as one of these Gen Xers who's hypercritical of everything, I think it's a terrible thing. No, I think it's a real concern with algorithms in general. And this is something that we're going to see more and more of. And this is also one of my main concerns with a cryptocurrency like Libra and Facebook's involvement in it is they'll have so much more data that we have no idea about it. And they'll be able to use that data and manipulate our credit scores, how much money we can get in ways that we just can't even fathom.
Yeah, but I think companies like Apple, I trust, I don't know if I should trust them, but I trust a company like Apple more than I do, let's say, some banking institutions that have gone under, and especially some investment bankers. So I think if their head is in the right place, yes, they're going to be building out these new products. They're going to be relying on a lot of data, and naturally, they're going to need to be adjusted and fine-tuned over time. So I think they've got the consumer's best interest at heart. And when this came out, they immediately addressed it and said they're going to fix it, which is good. I mean, they could just turn around and try brush it under the carpet, which I think would be worse. I think we'll see it happening more and more as long as it happens with the right companies.
The Apple Card is not actually from Apple, right? It's from Goldman Sachs, which is a financial institution which has a disreputable past already.
Whose algorithm is it making these decisions?
It's Goldman Sachs. Like, okay. Basically, yeah. Apple is slapping their logo on this.
Yeah, Okay, so I mean, that adds another angle, right? Yeah. So if Apple are fronting this up as an Apple product and relying on third parties to do that, that whole sort of supplier management piece and the reputational damage that could potentially be caused is another factor that's probably worthy of discussion.
But that's where the trust of Apple comes in, because I think if this was a Goldman product that was fronted by Goldman, I think the reaction would have been very different. But because it's a Goldman product that's fronted by Apple, as soon as this blew up, I would have expected that Apple would have turned around to the Goldman executives and said, fix this immediately, because this is ruining Apple's reputation, mm-hmm. not Goldman's reputation. I don't think Goldman's have much to lose here.
No. And from that whole deal, Goldman is somewhat protected, it seems like, albeit on relatively slim margins, but a really good deal for Goldman's, who don't have to front up any of that consumer anxiety or anything like that, even though it's essentially their product.
So maybe a Goldman algorithm, but actually Apple's on the hook for it. So I think they should have a lot of influence over it. And if they don't, I would be a bit worried if I was Apple.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to Apple's Silicon Valley rival, Google. Google is dipping its toes in the fintech game, it seems. They already have, obviously, Google Pay and the Google Wallet on Android phones, and they're looking to expand this into, at least in the U.S., checking accounts. It seems that Google will basically be slapping their logo on some products, but these products are going to be coming from institutional banks in the U.S. that historically don't have a vast fintech presence because they are threatened by the likes of N26 and Revolut.
I mean, from a user acquisition point of view, I could see it potentially being lucrative for those banks. When you look at the propositions of the challenger banks, N26, Monzo, Revolut, how are they going to differentiate when using someone else's product, and will that gain as much traction as a new challenger bank that really has none of the restrictions of old financial rails and has a consumer at its heart? I don't think it's going to work.
And I mean, this kind of speaks again to like my little rant a little bit earlier about data manipulation. Giving Google more information about all of your financial transactions, along with all of your search history and your internet history, it's just another massive data point for them on you.
I think that is a concern from consumers, but I think it's a natural trend. I mean, we'll be doing that when we travel to China with Alipay and those wallets. I think we're indirectly doing it in the Western world when it comes to our current banks and advertisers. It's a bit more fragmented in the approach. I mean, I think the only way incumbent banks are going to stay relevant is if they partner up with the likes of the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, and provide them with, let's say, the banking rails. The way I see the future of traditional banking is APIs. I see them just providing APIs to financial institutions and to whoever wants to build a really cool layer on top of it. And then whoever's good at acquiring users is going to win. I think the neobanks will do better because they'll be building on a fresh tech stack. But you can't discount the likes of Google, who just have access to billions of consumers at the click of their fingers.
Sure. I'd also, just to add to my other point, this week we also found out that Google is collecting health data on millions of Americans.
So Google's done a deal with some healthcare companies in the US to share that data with an idea of developing products around it.
Okay, because that's quite interesting, because yesterday Apple announced that they're opening their research app within the iPhone to US users. Mm-hmm. So if you're a US user of an iPhone or an Apple Watch, there are certain studies that you can enroll for, and they're sending that data to specific hospitals and, mm-hmm. yeah, let's say, research firms.
From the health app.
From the health app, yeah. So I think it's a plug onto the health app. There's kind of features that we won't be able to see here in Europe, but they'll be able to access there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining me on this week's edition of Tinfoil Hat Crazy Conspiracy Week on PPro Podcast. Really appreciate your time.
I think it's worthy of another conversation, actually, because it mirrors a conversation we had quite a few weeks ago with Jeremy, one of our colleagues, who's a French-American, and he was very much in your camp, whereas James and I were like, the amount of data people have, it develops useful technology for me and stuff, and actually the benefit I get from people having all of this data far outweighs any of my risks. If someone knows that I probably should jog more, I'm not that concerned.
We're optimists, Niall.
That's I think we're on the optimist side, and we see data as currency. Yes, I know I'm giving up a lot of my personal data, but I'm getting value for it. Mm-hmm. So I'm using data to purchase value. It's not in a traditional sense where I'm using cash to buy goods. I'm buying something else. I'm buying experience. I'm buying convenience. That's what I'm buying.
Yeah.
I'm buying convenience with my data.
All right. And on that note, I will say goodbye and thank you again for joining.
Cheers now.
Cheers. Speak to you next time.
All right. Ciao, guys. Thanks for listening to the PPro Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, make sure to subscribe on Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you hear podcasts, and leave a review. If you'd like to follow PPro on social media, you can follow them at PPro_payments. This podcast only sounds good because of Andre Ratke. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.